Okay, any preliminary issues, questions? We have our normal Q&A today at 11 right here, or I guess at 10 minutes after 11. We'll take a little break after 11. Yes, sir?
That was my question.
Okay. Okay, well, we left off yesterday, I think it was Mr. Rubio who was talking to us about Hayes versus Far West, and as you'll recall, the facts of the case are that the lawyer in question is hanging out at this bar doing some business, apparently. But engages in some kind of a dispute with somebody in the bar. It degenerates. Eventually, they're out in the parking lot. The lawyer takes the gun out and shoots the plaintiff. And the issue before the house is whether or not the lawyer's employer, the law firm, can be held vicariously liable for what he did out in the parking lot. And the plaintiff's argument was based on this case, Dickinson versus Edwards, which was a company Christmas party where the employer provides alcohol and the employee, while in the course and scope of employment, over-consumes alcohol and later gets into an automobile accident. And the court holds that his activity of drinking alcohol in the course and scope of employment made the employer vicariously liable, and just in the same way, the plaintiff in Hayes wants the court to hold the employer of the lawyer liable for what he did out in the parking lot. And again, the question is that case, is the Dickinson case on all fours, so to speak? Does it match up point for point with what happened in Hayes?
Well, the court has to decide first whether or not the lawyer was acting in the course and scope. So they look back at the Dickinson case and they look at the three criteria.
Course and scope of, when is it that he's acting in the course and scope of employment? I mean, what do we need? What does the plaintiff want to show is the moment when he was acting in the course and scope of employment? Again, do we need to show that the lawyer out in the parking lot when he fires the weapon is in the course?
He was in the bar.
In the bar drinking. That's where we got to tie in the connection to the employer. Could the employer plausibly say that this lawyer was certainly not doing business for our firm while he's sitting in the bar drinking? Could they get away with it?
Not based on the evidence.
What's the crucial piece of evidence that dooms that argument?
Well, they build.
They build for it. You'd think the law firm facing, you know, the potential liability would forego a couple of hours of billing in the cocktail lounge, but no, the bill goes out. So on that basis, there's no way they can avoid the finding that, at least as to them, the lawyer was doing their work while he's sitting at the bar drinking, just as the guy at the Christmas party, though he acted negligently in over-consuming, the consumption of alcohol was not outside the course and scope of his employment. Okay. Lolly?
Is there any significance that this guy is a partner at the firm and is an actual owner?
I don't remember that.
He is an owner of this. It's a personal service corporation.
So, well, he's the owner of a personal service. Where does it say this here?
In that
His name is mentioned in the law.
So I just assumed that he was a partner or a principal.
The name of the firm includes him, but his status vis-a-vis the firm as a PS, as a professional services corporation, his status may be that of an employee, and he may be a shareholder, but a shareholder is, you know, I own stock in a corporation, but that doesn't make me a partner exactly. Anyway.
Would it be any different if that was a general partnership?
If he were a general partnership, it might. To be honest, I'm not all that swift on the partnership law that would be applied in that circumstance. I'm more focused here on the status of an employee, whether it would make a difference that he's a partner. I don't think so, because my impression, again, sort of speaking with 25 years of distant memory of learning partnership law, is that partners are essentially treated as they're one another's. The model of a partnership is that everybody's an employee of everybody else. Okay. In any event, so here we are trying to draw the connection, and the plaintiff's arguing successfully that he's in the course and scope of employment while he's drinking. Okay, is there anything else we need to establish in order to hold the law firm accountable? If his drinking was in the course and scope of employment, what else, Ms. Peterman? Okay, but let me ask you a question. What happens when you drink alcohol?
You do stupid things.
Yeah. You know, that guy over at the bar who, when you were sober, you would recognize was a real loser, you know, after a couple of drinks, suddenly it seems like maybe that's not such a bad idea. Okay? So, yeah, but the other question is, in Dickinson, you're right. I know I have to drive home, so as I'm deciding whether to refill my glass here, the thought, well, wait a minute, I got to drive home here, a reasonable person would recognize that continuing to drink is going to affect my ability to drive. Whereas in this case, you could argue he had no way of anticipating that his drinking would put him at risk for later gunplay. On the other hand, again, would it not be at least foreseeable that he knows, as he sits there, that he does have a firearm in his car? It's not as though he gets into a fist fight or something. So having the firearm may be in the same way that I know I have to drive home, even though the odds are very good that after a couple of extra drinks, I'll still make it safely home. I mean, the odds have fallen from 999 out of 1,000 to 99 out of 100. I've just had an increase of risk by a factor of 10, which is why we don't like people to drink and drive. But relatively speaking, it's still more probable than not that I'm going to get home. How likely does it have to be that the consumption of alcohol will lead me to the place where I'm going to make a stupid decision about using that firearm? Is it foreseeable? Now, who decides that question, whether something's foreseeable? You'd think so, but it turns out that the question of foreseeability, we'll get to this in Chapter 2, Washington is one of those jurisdictions that treats the existence of foreseeability as a question of whether it triggers a duty of care. So they say that if you couldn't imagine a risk occurring, if it's totally unforeseeable, then it's a question of law for the judge. And the judge says, well, gee, if no one could have foreseen this, then it becomes, as a matter of law, he would owe no duty. He could get as snockered as he wants, and that would not be negligent. Again, it seems a little strange that a guy who's billing clients for what he's doing is not negligent for getting drunk. But that's what the court says. It's a done. Court says, not foreseeable. Now, this is, to me, a good example of a case where it seems like the plaintiff has a pretty good basis, pretty good precedent to transfer over and say, gee, this case is just like Dickinson. See how well it matches up. But the court says, not so fast. This is an issue. There's a difference between sitting at the bar drinking when you know you have a firearm in your car. Well, the other thing we might want to know about McGrath is what other indicators might he have. Does he have, who is it in the Robert De Niro, his co-star, anger management. Does he have anger management issues such that, again, as he's engaged in the practice of law here, conversing with somebody, negotiating, that this might spill into other kinds of arguments, disputes that he would be led to. Now, again, the significance of this issue is whether or not you're able to tap the deep pocket that has the money to pay the plaintiff's judgment in a case like this where the plaintiff suffered very serious damages from a gunshot wound. McGrath may be unable to pay for it out of his own pocket. His ability to practice law is now in jeopardy. He got fired from his firm, and all sorts of other bad things are happening. His world is crashing down on him. The plaintiff may be able to show he did a very terrible thing, and he's liable for a huge amount of money, but if he can't pay it, the plaintiff's going to go uncompensated. By contrast, if the law firm can be drawn into this, if they can be made to be vicariously liable for what he did, then the plaintiff stands to get a decent recovery. So, again, as you look at these questions, for exam purposes, you want to see whether or not there are vicarious liability issues. And one of the things I want to point out in the notes is this idea about the difference between an employee and an independent contractor. You may, in your employment history, have been paid as an independent contractor. Oftentimes, instead of paying you a salary or a fixed hourly wage, your employer will tell you, well, you're going to get paid as an independent contractor. You'll get paid on the basis of commission or on the basis of some kind of piece rate. You do this amount of work, you get paid this amount of money. And there may be tax angles and other kinds of issues associated with it. But for purposes of vicarious liability, the question is not so much how the employer has designated it for payment or tax purposes. The question is, does the employer, the putative employer, we're trying to figure out whether for vicarious liability purposes they truly are an employer or someone who is hiring an independent contractor. The question is whether the target here has the right to control what this person did. And as an example, if I hire a plumber to come in and fix something that's wrong with my plumbing, a leaky washing machine or a replace a hot water heater or something, person I hire, I pay by the hour, may mess up, the natural gas line or whatever it is and cause an explosion. Can I be sued and held vicariously liable for what someone working for me did? The intuitive answer is no. The reason for that is because I lack the right to control the way the plumber does the work. So I don't tell the plumber, oh, don't worry about the, you know, code violation there. Go right ahead and, you know, splice up those two pipes there. Plug this thing in over there. Typically, the plumber tells me, okay, this is what you got to do, and I pay for it. So, to the extent that I have the right to control, I can become vicariously liable for what someone does who is working for me. Again, a real estate broker may employ a series of sales agents to go out and show properties and tell customers about the properties and get them to purchase and thereby earn the broker a commission. The sales agent may be paid as an independent contractor. For every house you sell, you get, you know, 1% of the sale price, and I get the other, you know, 3% or whatever the deal is. But if the broker has the right to control the way the sales agent conducts business, then that sales agent is an employee for purposes of vicarious liability. So if the sales agent fudges a few details, well, that roof looks okay to me, I'm sure those water stains are just, you could just wallpaper over that, that would be fine. If you commit some act of misrepresentation, the broker will be vicariously liable for that because the broker has the right to control how the sales agent behaves. Now remember, the fact that the employee disobeys the clear instructions of the employer doesn't take them outside the course and scope of employment. It does not remove vicarious liability. If the trolley company begs and pleads with the trolley operators and says, please, whatever you do, ring the gong before you go through the intersection. Stay sober on the job. Don't speed. If I catch you speeding, I'm going to fire your rear end. No matter how explicit it is that these are the rules, that the violation of those rules doesn't remove it from the course and scope of employment. Even though the driver is drunk and speeding and so forth, they're in the course and scope of employment. The one area where they go outside the course and scope of employment is with respect to intentional torts. So if the truck driver gets out of his truck and chases down a motorist who cut him off and whacks him over the head with a tire iron, it's not in the course and scope of employment. If they're chasing each other on the highway, well, that's a different story. It's probably still just negligent driving. Again, for purposes of the exam, you simply want to ask the question, has this employee strayed so far from the task assigned to him or her that it's now beyond the course and scope of employment? Now, one of the items that's been very much in the news of late is the Catholic Church and the cases of priests abusing children. And the initial argument in many cases was that and this is obviously not limited to the Catholic Church, lots of other institutions, schools and nonprofit organizations and scouting organizations, and you name it. Lots of places have similar kinds of cases. But in the case of someone who is using, and this is typically the way it happens, somebody uses their position of authority to gain the trust of someone whom they later exploit. In fact, there was an early case, and this doesn't represent the trend, but it was at least a possibility once upon a time. There's a case in Los Angeles it was a Riverside County sheriff who answered a domestic dispute call takes the woman who was, I think, had placed the original call. He takes her, you know, in the squad car, and then sexually assaults her. And Riverside County was held liable on a vicarious liability theory with the thought, well, wait a minute, he used all the trappings of his, you know, the flashing lights and the badge and all of these traits of authority to get her to trust him. And although obviously he was doing everything contrary to what the police department stands for, it was still, in effect, under their auspices that he was able to do these things. Now, most jurisdictions have rejected that concept and have said, particularly in the case of sexual assault, particularly in the case of the exploitation of children, that in no way, no matter how much I'm a priest, you can trust me, I'm a police officer, you can come with me, no matter how much that is done, or the trappings of authority are used to perpetrate the crime, it doesn't make the employer vicariously liable. But that doesn't end the story, as you well know. And this Wackenhut case that's cited here someplace, at the bottom of page 42 in the right-hand column, plaintiff goes to a rock concert. Guy in a security t-shirt says, hey, you want to get closer to the stage? Oh, sure, says the plaintiff and her friends. Or maybe it's just the plaintiff. In any event, the security officer takes her, well, we got to crawl onto the stage here, you know, whatever. While they're in this secluded place, he sexually assaults her. She sues Wackenhut, and they say, well, gee, this guy's outside the course and scope of employment. What does she say? You were negligent in hiring this guy. And that's the problem, obviously, that the Catholic Church has gotten into, that the negligence in hiring or supervision, it's obviously something more than just an employment relationship, but to the extent that for legal purposes it has that characteristic, the question is, what would a reasonable person do in supervising people with that degree of authority, dealing with folks who will trust them for all sorts of purposes? Now, from a defendant's standpoint, whether you're a school district or you are a church or you are organization that has vulnerable people in your care, where you have trusted employees who can have these confidential relationships, what does a reasonable person do in hiring and supervising such folks? Think about the learned hand test for a moment. What is the burden of additional inquiry, supervision, so forth? What is the probability of harm? My goodness, sad to say, the probability of harm, if you run an institution that does confidential work with vulnerable people, that's just where the predators go. And so the probability of some harm occurring from people on the outside look like just, you know, the finest folks, but they turn out to be monsters. Well, the probability of harm is actually a lot higher than you would at first suspect. And then, what's the magnitude of harm? The magnitude of harm is almost incalculable. So, if you're the plaintiff, kind of have a field day with that. What employer can stand up and say, oh, we did everything that was reasonably required, you can't blame us for what happened? How are we to know that this was occurring? Well, you go back and look at it, and you find there are all sorts of telltale signs. Do you know the Mary Kay Letourneau case? Just so that, for once, it's not a man, you know, exploiting a woman or a child. You know, Mary Kay Letourneau, God bless her, has evened the scale a little bit. She was this, a sixth grade teacher over in Tacoma or someplace. Where was it? Mr. Tata? Okay, so this is a sixth grade teacher who has all sorts of problems, as it turns out. She has a husband and four children, I think, but she has all sorts of issues, shall we say, she goes after one of her sixth grade students and seduces him and has a child. She goes to prison, gets out, goes back to him. They have another child. But as to the first one, he wound up, Vili is his name, Vili sued the school district, saying, in effect, you did a poor job of protecting me. And it was all complicated by all of the issues about, you know, public perceptions about whether it's really all that bad for a sixth grade boy to be seduced by a sixth grade teacher. I mean, you know, from the standpoint whatever you might say about psychological development, and how bad it is, the public perception might be, what's really so terrible about that? There are also, I think, there are all kinds of questions about his own culpability or honesty. He was 19 by the time he finally sues the school district. He had gotten some kind of TV deal, the whole thing was quite sorted. The defense attorney for the school district is, I think, the vice president, or he is slated next year, the year following, to be the chairman of the board of trustees for Gonzaga University. His name is Mike Patterson. And it was on Court TV. I don't know if you saw any of it, there it was, this trial about, again, the school district's liability. And there's some pretty bad evidence that here these two are going off together, you know, sort of in a kind of confidential way. I mean, I don't think they knew or even suspected that they were going off to have sex, but they were caught in compromising positions, and this was, you know, the school district was made aware of this, not directly. It's all clear in 2020 hindsight. You have to sort of appreciate the fact that people would not have, at the time, caught on to it so easily. But again, looking at it with 2020 hindsight and asking the question, again, if you flipped it around, if it were a male teacher and a female victim, I don't think the jury would have had any hesitation in finding the school district was liable. But again, my point is that if the standard is one of reasonable care, the question is what resources would a reasonable person expend to avoid cases like this? And it's no fun from a defendant's standpoint. Either you concede the enormous damage that is done to children or other vulnerable people, adults with disabilities. It's just the most heartbreaking stuff. Breaks your heart. But either as a defendant, you concede, yes, oh, it's the very worst possible thing, but nonetheless, what we did, pitiful as it was enough given the circumstances. Mr. Tata? Right. again, the school district is in a position of putting her, you know, a sixth grade teacher, my son just finished the seventh grade, so the sixth grade was not that long ago, you know, sixth graders, you put a teacher in charge of sixth graders, that's a pretty challenging situation. They're all full, they're all maturing at different rates. You know, they're all full of, you know, many of them are already, hormones are in full swing. You have a really high level of responsibility. What are you doing as a school district to ensure that the people who are put in that position are fit, are capable of bearing that responsibility? You can't watch them all the time. Now, normally a sixth grade teacher is doing stuff with a class full of people and nothing really terrible can happen right then. But if you're going to do your job, there are lots of opportunities where kids stay after class, you meet them, you know, you go on field trips, you do all sorts of other stuff. If the teacher is up to no good, as we know from the experience of the Catholic Church and the priests, there are all sorts of opportunities for mischief. So again, as an institution, asking yourself the question, what are we doing about this? How much should we be doing? It's pretty easy to go back with 20/20 hindsight and say, hey folks, you didn't do enough. And again, the perpetrator is likely to be in jail. But you can't collect from the perpetrator if you're the plaintiff, so you go after the institution, and then the institution is sitting there saying, well, gosh, we thought Father so-and-so was a nice guy. We thought Mrs. Letourneau, gee, she's married, she has four kids. What, you know, what could be going on there? I mean, who would have thunk it? But, again, with 20/20 hindsight, it looks also clear. Mr. Ortiz? Well, again, the bad news for the school district is it's a standard of reasonable care. Who determines whether you complied with the standard of reasonable care? A jury. It's a sad commentary that the saving grace, as it were, if that's not the wrong phrase to use, for the school district is that the victims, and I think this is true in the Veeley-Letourneau case, the victim was such a mess that the jury has a hard time kind of identifying with the victim. I'll tell you another little war story. Old friend of mine, first guy I really practiced law with side by side for a firm downtown, his wife has been the doctor at Gonzaga for 20 years. She's a great doctor, Nancy Crotty. Her husband Bob works for a firm downtown, Lucas Yannis. He represented these two girls, I cite the case later on actually, these two girls who were put in foster care. There was something going on in their family and they needed foster care. So the State Department of Social and Health Services does this workup to decide, you know, and there's this guy who's in the pool, eligible to be a foster parent. They go out and interview this guy. And so they ask him all kinds of different questions. You know, do you have any pets? You know, oh yeah, I got a dog. What's the dog's name? Spot or whatever. Well, one of the questions they didn't ask him is, oh, by the way, have you ever committed a crime? The answer to that question would have been yes. Or have you ever been charged with a crime? Yes. Crime, attempted rape. Guess what happens to these two girls? They're sexually abused by this foster parent. Bob, representing these girls, sues the state. And the reason the case is cited later on in Chapter 5 is that the case goes all over the map procedurally to try to figure out what's the duty of care. Is the state liable for what foster parents do, or is the state immune under some, you know, reading of the state law with regard to immunity? But after he got through this labyrinth of appeals and all kinds of stuff, and finally got the case to trial, well, the girls are in their early 20s, as I recall, and have had a very tough life. The abuse combined with the circumstances of their the reason they got into foster care in the first place, you know, they've been in and out of trouble with the law, you know, all kinds of unhealthy relationships with people, addictions of various kinds, you name it. Well, again, from a defendant's standpoint, you can't say, hey, damaged goods, not our problem, you know. They were a mess when they got here. The guy, you know, sexually abused them, but they were going to be no damn good anyway. I wouldn't recommend that as a defense strategy, you know. At the same time, the plaintiffs have a very difficult time. I think this is what happened to Veeley. By the time, you know, they got to trial trying to blame the school district, he had behaved in ways that the jury, I think, eventually said, gee, we're just not sure what all happened here and how much of this was really the school district's fault. So again, these cases can be just kind of a roller coaster I should also say they require an enormous amount of personal sensitivity, both for the plaintiff's lawyer and the defense lawyer. You know, these are areas where none of us particularly feels comfortable, and there's, as you know, as there has been here, a lot of nervous laughter over things that are just very personally painful. Statistically speaking, there are probably many of you for whom this is no laughing matter at all. At the same time, we're all looking for a way to kind of avoid having this just cut to the heart and be just this horrible experience. So again, in my professional practice, I had a case representing when I was doing insurance defense for a firm in California, we represented an agency who had a guy serving in what was called respite care, taking parents with kids with disabilities. One of the reasons they liked this guy was that he himself had cerebral palsy, but he had a real gift for working with kids and, you know, kids with disabilities, and he was quite, you know, got around quite well and so forth and so on. One of the parents came home early one night from the respite care, finds him in an abusive situation with that parent's child, and then once they uncovered, you know, once they pulled the lid off of this, it turned out there were 20 other victims. So our agent, you know, the client I represented, the insurance company had a written policy for, that agency was sued, again, under these similar vicarious liability, negligent hiring and supervision theories, and just, again, going to the preliminary hearing as this guy was being criminally charged and listening to the testimony was just, I've had far more pleasant days earning a living. But at the same time, it's an area where if you have a heart and you have some compassion and some decency, it's a place where you can also do a lot of good. And again, sad to say, I wish this were some aberrant thing that hardly ever, you know, came up, but sad to say, it's sort of a daily fixture of most institutions, misbehavior in this area, and it turns out to be extremely expensive, just as another sort of reality check here. I was involved in starting up a small school, private school, 8 years ago or so, and I was delegated the task of going out and getting insurance. Well, most of the time, applying for the insurance dealt with what are your policies with regard to sexual abuse. You know what, you know, and there were specific dollar limits. We'll cover you to the extent of $20,000, that's it. And all sorts of other restrictions, because that was sort of, you know, job one for them, for the insurance company, was saying, how do we avoid getting taken to the cleaners because of the prevalence of these kinds of cases? Ms. Reed.
I had a question on the employer. They're limited on some of the questions they can ask.
Yeah.
So how, if they're in a sensitive situation, they're allowed to ask.
Well, you got to do what you got to do, and again, from the standpoint of reasonable care, the fact that what is it going to take another hour? I mean, what is it? Is it what are the steps that you could take to? And also, I would say not just on the hiring end of it, but on the supervision end of it. I think that's probably where most institutions are vulnerable. You do some things on the hiring end, but what do you do in an ongoing way to monitor the care that you're providing, so that before something erupts into a full-blown problem, you've had a little early warning on it. Again, it's a sad commentary on the state of things that this is such a common thing. Okay, any other questions? Yeah,
Mr. Gallagher. Can you summarize, please, the steps, a general procedure that we might keep in mind when...
Oh, for vicarious liability?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The first thing is that employees are that the employer is liable for negligent acts committed by an employee in the course and scope of employment. An employer is also liable for negligent hiring and supervision. An employer is not liable for acts done by an independent contractor, and an independent contractor is one whose activities the employer does not have the right to control. Actual control may be lacking, it's the right to control. So again, if I kid shows up at my door and says, I'd like to mow your lawn, I'd like to, you know, would you like me to mow your lawn for $15? And I say, sure. I go back in the house and watch TV, he goes and mows my lawn. I still may have the right to control the way he does it. I could go out there and tell him, you know, don't do this, don't do that. Therefore, he is my employee rather than my independent contractor. Okay, now let's. Were there other.
So
Mr. Rocher? Yeah. Well, more to the point, if he injured somebody else. Right. I'm trying to remember, there's actually a commercial. The guy's mowing his lawn. It's like, turns out to be bare lawn. And you see these windows breaking right and left. It turns out the ground is bare, and he's apparently picking up rocks with his lawn. I can't even remember what I think it's from some hardware shop or something. I forget who does the ad, but in any event, I thought, oh, great illustration here. You know, the employee's activity injures somebody else. The rock hits a person, and you say, oh, it's you, it was negligent to run a lawnmower over a rock where you know that the thing is going to fire him like a missile. So the question would be, if I try to say, as the homeowner, oh, no, he's my independent contractor, he mows the lawn, I pay him $15, the question is not method of payment, the question is, do I have the right to control? Can I go out and tell him, do this, do that? I can't do that with a plumber. I can't say, oh, don't bother with that stuff. the plumber's governed by a set of, you know, of professional standards, and I can't direct him as to how to do it or not do it.
Do you have the rent control, like, when you start going on?
I think I do. Yeah, I can go out there and say, no, use the hand clippers on that. Don't use the lawnmower on that part. Whereas, again, if the dentist is working on my teeth, you know, the professional, I will have some choices, perhaps. Do you want the gold crown or the, you know, whatever? But I don't have a right to determine the kinds of things that are governed by professional standards. Redden?
Does the like, same vicarious liability standard hold true for like volunteer workers?
Yes, that's actually, and again, even for institutions like, you know, Big Brothers and Sisters or some other organization that relies on volunteers, they may fall into the same, even though you don't pay them, they may be your employees from the standpoint that, again, you have the right to control the way the work is done. And also the same issues, even though some intentional act is committed outside the course and scope of employment, the question in that case would be negligent hiring. You know, if I'm a single parent and I entrust my kid to Big Brothers and Sisters, but they don't use reasonable care in screening who's got time alone with my kid, then I'm going to blame them for, you know, the failure to use reasonable care. Mr.
Rocher? You're saying the state of Washington judges kind of a matter of law decides the ability to get a jury decide reasonable care to
do? That's correct. We actually, there's a case in Chapter 2 which is sort of the mother of all tort cases. It's called the Paul's Draft. And there are a couple of sort of classic cases that every law student, you know, suffers through, Pennoyer versus Knapp and civil procedure, and all these sort of standard miserable cases, and Waltraff is one of them. But it goes right at that issue, and there's a huge fight between the majority and the dissent, and we'll go into this whole question. It gets kind of philosophical, but yeah, I shouldn't have gone there. Long and short of it. But you did state it quite accurately that determining whether a duty of care is owed is a question of law for the judge. Now, even that may be based upon disputed factual claims. So I'm just remembering a case I had. I do this summary of Washington tort law. And I remember a case a couple of years ago where this woman is having emotional problems and she goes to see a coworker and she shares her, problems with him. They sit around the table with a, you know, bottle of wine. She may be taking, I can't remember if she was taking some sort of sleeping pills or whatever it is. She goes to sleep on the couch and it turns out overdosed herself and died. Her estate sued him and he said, I didn't know her duty of care. As a matter of law, I'm not responsible. And then, so the court had to figure out, well, wait a minute, when you take her in your home, you know, you have some duty, knowing that she's in this emotional state, you know, at what point is there a duty of care to be your brother's keeper, or in this case, your sister's keeper, you know? So that kind of question, the court says, in determining whether somebody owes a duty of care, the boundary of legal duty, that is a question of law for the judge. Once we've determined, which is, again, most of the, virtually all the cases I have, duty of care is not an issue. The only question is, having a duty of care, did you meet that duty? Did you use reasonable care or were you negligent? So, again, Chapter 2 and then later, even in Chapter 11, we come back to these much more difficult questions of how do you define the boundaries of what duties we owe to one another. When do I have a duty to be my brother or sister's keeper? When can I say, look, you know, it's not like I ran her over, it's not like I committed malpractice against her. She shows up at my door, we have a, you know, bottle of wine to listen to her troubles, she goes off to sleep it off, yeah, I didn't pay any attention to her after that, and well, maybe I should have, but I'm not legally liable for it, am I? Again, that's the kind of thing the court says, we'll take that question. Yes, Mr. Cleveland.
And the neighbor just far with, was the lack of foreseeability during their duty on the part of the employee or the employer?
Well, again, in the end, what the court says is, even though he was in the course and scope of employment, unlike the guy at the Christmas party who gets drunk and later has to drive, the guy, the lawyer drinking at the bar, wasn't negligent. Now, again, it seems kind of startling, but that's the way the court distinguishes the cases. That's why the rule in Dickinson can't simply be moved over and plopped down on this case. It doesn't even get to a jury because, again, the court says, we don't think there was the basis for asserting that he had reason to fear that his action could be negligent. Okay? No. He's still in the course and scope of employment. I mean, again, the court, we never quite get the sense of it is sort of charting his blood alcohol content during the course of this and the relationship between the time he was billing his client on the job and at what point he laid his stylus from his Palm Pilot down and stopped billing and kept drinking. Minerva Chivi kept on drinking. When that happened is not clear. But again, what the court says, regardless, even if the buildup of alcohol in his system, the impairment of his judgment started while he was on the job, he was free to do that because he had no reason to think there was any risk to anybody else. It's like throwing a baseball at a, you know, brick wall. I have no reason to think that throwing a baseball at a brick wall is going to hurt anybody. Yeah. Again, this goes to his anger management issues. You would think that there's at least something. If I were the plaintiff, I would want an opportunity to kind of explore all the reasons why it was negligent, why he had reason not to be drinking at this bar while trying to practice law. But the court looked at that and said, "We don't think you can get there from here." Now, again, you know, cases like this may stick in your craw, saying, "Well, gee, this is really dumb." But what you want to do is sort of look at the principle. I got the principle clearly in mind here of what is the standard for vicarious liability. When does the institution, the employer, have to pay, and when is the plaintiff stuck collecting from the individual miscreant who did the wrong thing, but apparently was acting on his own rather than being having his actions attributable to somebody with deeper pockets? Okay, let's just get started with strict liability. We'll spend 5 minutes on strict liability, take a break, and come back. I can think of no better way to sort of introduce the distinction between strict liability and negligence in this charming little case of Helen versus Carey. Mr. Griffin, why don't you tell us about the Helen?
The plaintiff, Barbara Helen, sued the defendants, Dr. Carey and Dr. Laughlin, I mean negligence and malpractice resulting in non-infected glaucoma and deterioration of eyesight. Defendants are partners who specialize in ophthalmology. And the plaintiff consulted with the defendants occasionally and then repeatedly from 59 through 68. In August of 68, the defendant performed a pressure test. The test allowed the defendants to determine that the plaintiff had glaucoma, and apparently for years. The plaintiff consulted with another physician in 69 and filed a complaint against the defendant.
Okay, so the complaint is, if you had diagnosed my glaucoma earlier, I would have had time to treat it, but since it wasn't diagnosed until late in the game, I'm stuck with this, 5% vision. I've got this like a little spotlight that I can go around looking at, but that's the limit of what I can see. Okay, so she files a complaint against the doctors. What happens when the case gets tried? Okay, so the plaintiff's the one who's appealing, and what's the basis of the plaintiff's appeal?
That the trial judge erred in giving certain jury instructions and refusing their gross instructions defining the standard of care.
Okay, and what's the difference? What was the instruction that was given? What's wrong with it? What's the instruction she wants? What's good about it?
I'm not sure.
What's the fight all about here? Now, of course, the court divides on whether that's even the name of the game. The concurring judges want to go in a different direction altogether, but so we understand the way the case gets set up initially. The difference between the two instructions is actually reminiscent of an issue we dealt with earlier. Ms. Jones? Okay, that's what the defendant wants as the standard. Did this doctor follow the standard of care for ophthalmologists? The plaintiff, on the other hand, Mr. Lobach? And what does this remind us of? Yeah, it's the Bennett T.J. Hooper disparity. Bennett says follow the industry custom and you're fine. T.J. Hooper says in the end courts must say what is reasonable care or not. So the plaintiff's appealing essentially to the logic of T.J. Hooper. She wants to be able to invite the jury to set a higher standard from the one followed by the industry. Well, in this case, it's the field of ophthalmology. What does the Supreme Court of Washington say?
They agree with that.
With whom?
With the plaintiff.
Okay, they agree with the plaintiff. What would you, as the defendant, say is not analogous about Hooper? Why is Hooper inapplicable to this case? You're the defendant. Glover?
Hooper was met.
Well, you could do the dictum holding distinction to say, oh, yeah. That's one of those mixed cases. Sure, in dictum, or in dicta, the learned hand goes off in this, statement about universal disregard and stuff, but that's not the holding of the case. But there's another way you could argue that T.J. Hooper is inapplicable to this case.
Is it just the rate of glaucoma in people under 4 years of age is so small that the test that she suggested should have been done? Or...
But see, the question, what the plaintiff wants to do is throw that question to the jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what do you think? Should they have given this test or not? Whereas the defendant says, I'm sorry, that's not for the jurors to determine. Ms. Beard?
Isn't it a level of professional expertise that's involved in
Yeah,
it?
There's a difference between running tugboats and practicing medicine. That we could give the jury, perhaps should give the jury the freedom to say, I'm sorry, tugboat owners, you're simply not living up to our standards. Whereas in this case, the plaintiff is asking to be able to go to the jury to determine how ophthalmology is practiced. And what does the Supreme Court use it? Sounds good to us. No wonder doctors hate lawyers. Among other reasons. But it's on that basis that the majority says, in effect, we don't think this standard should be left to the ophthalmologist. We want to have our say. Whereas the concurring opinion takes a different approach, and that's the one we want to talk about when we come back from the break. So let's take a 10-minute break and pick it up there.